Hello, and welcome to the Weekly Comic Spotlight on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayo.
And I'm Bob Breitall. In this episode, we'll be discussing recently released comics. One from DC, one from Marvel, and at least one other. As always, we'll keep major spoilers to a minimum, but we'll discuss general plot points and storylines of the comics we review.
This is Weekly Comics Spotlight 206 for comics originally released on July 20th, 2011. So while these came out during Comic-Con, both Bob and I are safely back home. I in Texas, you there in Irvine, and it sounds like you've got a bit of that con flu that seems to go around every year.
Yes, so I'm safely home physically, but I did pick up something that started manifesting itself by about Tuesday, and I've been not feeling good most of the week.
That
I got
sucks.
A little bit of a cough now, so traffic was pretty bad. It was like when I left the con, it was like people were playing bumper cars up the 5 freeway. There were 4 separate accidents.
Wow.
That I had to get by. It took me a little over 2 hours to get home, and I left the con at about 3:30.
Damn. You know, you probably saw more accidents just getting up to Irvine than my sister and I saw driving from San Diego to Austin, because I don't know that we really saw any.
I don't know what it was. I mean, it was like, because I didn't have any problem getting away from the convention center, you know, because I left a little early and I went this other way, not through downtown. But once I got on the freeway and got north of San Diego, it was just like accident. It was like in about a 15-mile stretch of road, there were like 4 accidents.
Wow. That's I hope everyone was okay and stuff.
It didn't, you know, I mean, didn't appear to be any deaths or anything, but, you know, it was enough that, I mean, they were some munched up cars, though. The first one was the worst, you know, and then the other ones after that seemed to be just little fender benders, you know, so.
Yeah. Okay, well, starting us off in DC, actually in the Vertigo section of DC, is Cinderella Fables Are Forever number 6. Now, I've really been enjoying this miniseries. I loved the previous one. I thought in this issue, they did a really good job reestablishing, just within this, kind of the backstory of you know, some of Cinderella's stuff, her interactions with Dorothy Gale, who's the big bad of the series, and really getting us back up to speed on kind of that rivalry, that stuff there, which really set the scene well for that great showdown between Cinderella and Dorothy Gale in this. And I loved how in some of that recap stuff, they were tying in the events, not necessarily directly from the Jack of Fables series, but from that branch of the Fables, you know, world and stuff, with the librarians, the book sisters and stuff like that getting referenced, and the pit where she would lose her memory, and, you know, story elements built up there.
Right.
I thought this was a really satisfying ending of this story, and I love how, of course, they leave it open for more Cinderella stories, which no doubt we're going to get.
I really like the way that Roberson tells the Cinderella stories, and as a matter of fact, I like the way that he structured the mini, because there were several points in the mini that you got, you know, kind of shocking reveals.
Yeah.
You know, that's like, oh, really? Wow, that's kind of cool. And, it, you know, it kept on building. It wasn't just, you know, didn't feel like it was just everything building to the very end. You had cool stuff happening along the way. So it paid off in single-issue form, as opposed to just paying off as a completed story. He did a good job on the pacing.
Yes.
Let's say.
Well, and what I liked about this is issue 6 out of 6, okay? In many cases, you would get the big fight at the end or whatever, having come in the middle, not really get the context, whatever. Here, the whole thing is the showdown between Cinderella and Dorothy, and we get enough through these flashbacks, through the exposition-type stuff or whatever, to really, just within this single issue, understand the long-term rivalry of these two characters, why they're at odds, and to really have that context and to care about the outcome between that showdown. And you know, to me, as again, just a single issue, I thought this held together really, really well. Sean McManus's art fit the story just beautifully. And, I mean, the only thing I would say that prevented this from being an absolute 5 out of 5 for me, and it came very close, was I was reading through this. Now, granted, I'm a little behind on my comics. I'm actually a short box behind, thanks to Comic-Con. I've read the other 5. I don't have a crystal clear memory of them in my mind, and I was trying to remember. It's like, so what was that thing that started this miniseries off that sent Cinderella down this path, whatever? And we don't really get that. But what we get here instead is the big picture of these two characters that are at odds. And again, like I said, it really ups the stakes and the relevance of this showdown beautifully. Whereas, if somehow he had, and maybe he didn't, I just have forgotten the other issues enough that I didn't pick up on it, you know, tied everything into, and this is what kicked this off that led to this exact moment or whatever. Because we really start the thing with Dorothy having the advantage over Cinderella, and Cinderella having to kind of think her way and fight her way out of this situation, which, you know, being the title character, guess what? She does. I was really impressed with just as a single issue how well this resolution of a story worked just as a single story. They could have done this as a one-shot, and if you're willing to accept, hey, you know, Dorothy has the upper hand going in, great. I love this stuff. I'm happy to see that they're going to be doing a new Fable series called Ferrest, which are going to be... They're billing it as kind of like a series of mini-series. And no doubt Cinderella is going to be one of the recurring characters that are going to have arcs through there.
They did say that. Willingham said that at the Fables panel at San Diego. Mm-hmm. And he said when they do a Cinderella arc, they want to get Chris Roberson and Sean McManus to do the Cinderella arcs, you know, but they'll have arcs on Sleeping Beauty, on Rose Red, and all the kind of female fables.
Yeah.
And I think that's a good, you know, kind of a good concept. And, you know, as far as publishing goes, I don't mind getting Fables and Cinderella in a month, you know, just like I didn't mind getting Fables and Jack of Fables. So if they just keep it to those two titles, I mean, I don't necessarily want to get like, you know, 3, 4, 5 Fables books every month, but if they just, you know, cool it on the miniseries and slide, you know, the Cinderella arcs into Ferrest instead of doing separate miniseries, I'm cool with getting, you know, 2 Fables books each month.
And I think that's a smart move, particularly if they stagger them to where it's like a Fables book every other week or something. I would be a little disappointed if we get both Fables and Ferrest in the same week, just because I think spacing it out makes sense.
Oh, yeah, certainly. I mean, you got to be respectful of fans' wallets, you know, in that respect, because, you know, you go out and you get multiple books all on the same day, you know, someone that's got $20, $30, $40 in their pocket, then they have to start making choices, not the best thing that you want to force someone to do.
Well, and also just keeping the interest up. I mean, how silly is it when DC, for example, would release Green Lantern, Green Lantern Corps, Green Lantern Emerald Warriors all in the same week, whereas if they had done them on 3 consecutive weeks, they could have kept that Green Lantern franchise, you know, up at the top of people's mind every week.
Yeah, they've been doing that a lot with Green Lantern lately, just shotgunning all the Green Lantern titles out in a single week.
It's a feast or famine thing, and I think Fables is an incredibly strong property. I think what they've done here with Cinderella is great. If they can do that same kind of a thing with these other female characters, I am all for that. And doing it in that ongoing series of miniseries format, I think, is a brilliant idea.
Well, the first arc is supposed to have Sleeping Beauty, and it's going to have Phil Jimenez doing art, and he does beautiful art. So
he does.
I'm really looking forward to that. That seems like a really strong way to kick that off. So
I got to think, though, that Roberson and McManus's work on this series and the previous miniseries is what got that Ferrest thing greenlit. I mean,
oh, sure, because it's been a really solid book. It's been really well done. And, you know, as such things go, I mean, relatively strongly received. At Comic-Con, the Fables panel is always very well attended, and it's all Fables. You know, it's not like DC and we'll Vertigo, and we'll talk about Fables also. It's like there's a whole panel for Fables, and you get, you know, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people, you know, sitting in a room to listen to Willingham and Buckingham and these guys talking about Fables. So it's a very popular property.
I'm actually going to change my rating. I was going to go with a very strong 4, but I am going to give this a 5 because it, like I said, it reestablished everything it needed to for this ending to really make sense, be relevant, even if I think you hadn't read the previous 5 issues. I think you should, of course, because like you said, each one had a good reveal, had good strong story moments, and was just a really fun read. And the fact that, I mean, this is... again, what's kind of kicked off the Ferrest as a ongoing series, you know, is something I think Roberson and Manish should be very proud of, and I'm looking forward to the next Cinderella arc they do over in that title, because this is just great stuff. I think it really shows both how talented these guys are, and what a great premise and story idea Willingham had that kicked the whole thing off with Fables so many years ago.
Yeah, I give it a 5 also. And I also kind of... It doesn't seem like they do miniseries anymore that are 3 or 4 issues. You know, they tend to... Unless it's kind of a tie-in. They tend to do the 6-issue ones just because that trades nicely.
Yeah.
You know, it'd be nice if they did some 3-issue story arcs in Ferrest.
And then you could always, issue
you know... Or sing, you know, whatever, you know, so that you can trade a couple of them together. But, you know, getting a issue here or there of Cinderella, just like a little quick solo mission or a 3-issue story, you know, once a year or every, you know, 18 months or something. Mm-hmm. It'd be nice to just keep the character because, I mean, I really like how she's the super spy, you know, and has the cover and all this kind of thing. It's a really cool idea that they came up with, and I would like to see more of it. But, yeah. You know, at the same time, I'd like to see, you know, Sleeping Beauty, Rose Red, you know, Snow White in something, Beauty. You know, there's all these different characters. And I think they signed Adam Hughes to be doing the covers, which is not going to hurt things one bit either. You know?
Yeah.
So...
I hope that series really catches on with readers because it seems like a brilliant idea.
Yeah. But it should be very well. You know, it should get done well. Anyway, really solid book. You know, read Fables. Also, if you're not reading Fables, we've got a bunch of people on the forum who are really big Fables fans. I'm a really big Fable fan.
Same here.
Just really well done.
If you haven't read Fables, go pick up the first trade. I think they had that at a reduced price or whatever, so it's not that much of an investment, and it really, I think, once I had read the first one and maybe the second one too, I was hooked, and the story seeds Willingham planted there are still bearing fruit today, and it is just a unbelievably a strong property, and one that really is worth picking up from the get-go to really.
And then we'll move over into Marvel.
Yeah.
We've got the return of the less noirish, brooding Daredevil. We've got back to the kind of the swashbuckling Daredevil from Mark Waid with Paulo Rivera and Marcos Martin on art. And we've got the first issue here in front of us. It came out with many covers, among them a sketch cover. But this issue has got 2 stories in it. We've got the first one has got the spot at the beginning and then just a little bit of Matt following it up. He kind of wraps up that spot stuff. And then we, you know, that's by Paulo Rivera. And then we have Marcos Martin on the kind of backup story in here to flesh out the issue. I believe this is $2.99 on an ongoing basis, but Marvel likes to hit the first issues at $3.99 because they sell better and they make an extra couple of bucks that way, if I'm not mistaken.
Now, did you notice that the first page was actually done by a different creative team?
Yes.
Van Lente wrote that, and I thought that was actually a fairly effective recap of Daredevil's origin and really gave the origin powers and essentials of Daredevil really in a tightly told thing. So the fact it was done by somebody else I found just kind of interesting. But again, smart use of the opening page.
Yeah, I did notice that, and it was at the same, you know, same thing. It was like I looked at it and was like, well, you know, it's not bad. I mean, because it was, like you said, it was effective, right?
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if they used this in one of the one-shots they did of the Marvel Hero Origins or whatever, where they did single-page things for everybody. In other words, we may have seen this page before. I don't know off the top of my head.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the minute we open the story and it's, oh, we're at the Cloisters, I could not help but think, you know, wasn't Nightwing based there for an issue or six? You know, which has nothing to do with anything, but it's kind of funny that Marvel is so known for being grounded in the real world, specifically of New York, that the few times DC or somebody else kind of encroaches on that reality, it's I always find that kind of funny.
Yeah, it's like, how dare you get real, DC, with your locations?
Yes. Well, and frankly, I think they used it better here than they did in Nightwing, where he took over as the museum curator. That six-issue arc just felt a little odd in that respect.
Well, it's like, I think the real problem with the DC stuff was their identity crisis, where they were, you know, not the series, but just how they had so many of those mid-list series that would completely change every 6 to 8 issues.
Yeah.
You know, Nightwing was like that. Supergirl was like that. You know, Power Girl, not on that much of a frequent basis, but she changed 2 or 3 times. And it's just like, you know,
well,
get a character and have them stay a certain way.
I think with Power Girl, it's a little different. Her status quo changed, but it wasn't like you were saying with Nightwing, where it seemed like every story arc they were trying to relaunch him in a new... He's got a new job, he's a trainer at a gymnasium, or he's a museum curator, or he's running a police bar, or...
Well, I think the difference was is that they just were able to keep creative teams around for a little longer stretch, but it was still like, you know, she's running Star Wars, she's not running it, she's running it again, you know? It's like, you know, make up your mind. She's got Batman guest starring in every issue.
Yeah.
Anyway, you know, Daredevil, I think that people are going to have mixed feelings about this. I really liked it, but then again, I grew up on this take on Daredevil. Whereas, you know, we've had for a long time now the really dark street-level Daredevil who's just getting, you know,
angsty,
slapped around and angst and really bad stuff happening to him on a continual basis. You know, 10 years or more. I mean, there are people in comics, a lot of people, that's the only Daredevil they've ever known.
I think that's a very good point to make, and I'm glad you did, because I hadn't really been thinking about that, but you're right. For easily a solid generation of readers, this is going to be a brand new take on Daredevil, and one, like you said, that may not work for them. Now, for me, I have been reading Daredevil for ages and stuff. I think I got on right around the time Frank Miller was doing the stuff around 220 or whatever of the original series is when I started picking it up off the rack. So I've gone through the different, you know, is it dark and brooding, is it light and airy, is it dark and, you know, kind of
stuff.
And
that's funny because when Frank originally took over Daredevil, that was probably about the first time that he kind of flipped to the dark and brooding mode.
Mm-hmm. But I'd also read some of the trades, which was the original, you know, Stan Lee and Ditko was the original artist on this, right?
I think Wally Wood started out for
first
couple issues.
The acrobatic, the light, this style of Daredevil at that point. So I've read both. But I think you're right. A lot of newer readers are going to be looking at that thinking, you know, why is he so happy-go-lucky? What happened?
Yeah, the very first issue of Daredevil was Steve Ditko and Bill Everett, but then it kind of moved off of that, and, you know, he had different creators. You know, it was like Joel Orlando came in there for a while, Wally Wood did some issues, you know, and Wally Wood's got, you know, a very different style. Wally Wood's the first one who drew him in the red costume, you know, cause he had that,
yellow and red for
first six issues. I guess the arms and legs and his cowl were yellow, which, you know,
for
guy's
newer,
blind, you know, give him a break.
For newer readers, D-Man of the Avengers used that for a while, who is not blind, so I think it takes on a whole different meaning there.
It's like, you know, but then, you know, Wally Wood did a lot. You know, my Daredevil, you know, Romita came in for a while on Daredevil, you know, lots of different people. But for me, when I first started reading Daredevil, it was Gene Colan.
Mm.
was doing it, and he was my Daredevil artist. You know, it was very different, you know, to see Gene Colan on Daredevil. My first issue of Daredevil was number 86 that I kind of stumbled on. That was in 1972, and it was Gene Colan on that. And, you know, just he was still light. I mean, not jokey light necessarily. He wasn't Spider-Man, but he was more like this, you know. It was very much this tone. He was a swashbuckling, you know, kind of superhero, and he wasn't...
It was a bright and sunny book. Yeah. It was not the Dark Knight, you know. It was the daytime Daredevil versus the nighttime one, if you will.
Right. Like in this issue, when he, like, is fighting the Spot, and he, you know, sweeps the bride up and gives her a kiss, you know. And, you know, it's just... That's not something that our Daredevil from the last 10 years would have probably thought of doing.
Yeah. I love the whole fight with Spot. Now, Spot's one of my favorite Marvel villains. He's silly looking, but his powers are just incredibly versatile and stuff. I was a little surprised what he did to the one guy who had, I guess, sold out that mob family or whatever, Sal Durante or whatever. And I frankly didn't care for the Radar Vision look for Spot, but he was a good villain to bring in, provided a challenge for Daredevil, and gave us that action quotient we really needed here. And really, Spot's use here was the supervillain du jour. He's not really adding to the story, but adding to the action level, which starts the book off on a strong note, because then a lot of the rest of it is, you know, kind of establishing Matt Murdock's status quo these days. And I think they made a really good point about how in today's world of the internet, surveillance, and, you know, CSI technology and stuff, how maintaining a secret identity would be next to impossible. Now, they phrased it a little more profanely than that, which I didn't think added to the story, but, you know, whatever. It's a relevant point, and I think the way Mark Waid chose to kind of counter and try to move past that everybody thinks they know Matt Murdock is Daredevil was actually pretty interesting and has a lot of story potential of just it's the next news cycle, who the hell cares? We'll see how that plays out going forward. There were one or two places in here where, even though I felt by and large the art was very well done, there were a couple of places I thought it was a little surprisingly ineffective. When Murdock is going into the courtroom, there's that one scene where he's chucking the coffee mug. And, I mean, clearly, I think it was meant to convey that even though he's being told, hey, you know, this is the paparazzi, they're looking for proof you're Daredevil and stuff, and he's just casually, you know, the blind man throwing his coffee cup straight into the wastebasket, you know, nothing but net kind of a thing. I think that panel could have been done better. I mean, I got the point of it, but I could see where somebody else would look at it and be confused. But that was about the only nitpick I really had on the art, other than, again, not being crazy about the way they depicted the Radar Vision, but I liked the fact that they did depict the Radar Vision aspect of the character. I thought the backup feature actually did a really good job on conveying the extra senses. But overall, I thought the lead story was good, set things up well, reestablished the status quo, and ended on an interesting note that I'm kind of curious about what happens next.
I didn't really care for Marcos Martín on Spider-Man,
mm-hmm.
but I didn't mind him here. And I had originally thought, oh, you know, they had listed Marcos as being taking over the book as artist on issue 4. I think what it really is they're probably going to be swapping back and forth on arcs between Paulo Rivera and Marcos Martin on the book to try to keep it on schedule or something, or allow them to, you know, put out multiple issues a month or whatever they like to do.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't mind his art on Daredevil. He has like his kind of signature, like that double page spread that he has.
Yeah.
He does that. I mean, that's a signature Marcos Martin, and he does it in several other places, like when they're walking down into the subway. Mm-hmm. You'll have one panel, and you know, you show the characters in like multiple locations throughout the panel, kind of moving through it.
Actually, that subway scene flowed well enough just as single panels. I hadn't really picked up on the fact that the architecture is, you know, anchored throughout. That was very well done.
Yeah, I mean, that whole page, you know, like he's walking up and they have on the left-hand side at the top panel, and then they show on the right-hand side they're walking down the stairs into the subway, and then, you know, they got three different images of the guys, you know, and then there's two of them in the bottom panel. So, I mean, it's like he draws three panels, but you get, like, in total,
at least five or
seven,
six.
Seven different locations, yeah, for Matt and Foggy. And it worked okay.
Well, what I found entertaining is going between that middle tier and that bottom tier where they're walking down the stairs. In the foreground of the top one, Matt's walking down, but where his legs would be in the next panel is somebody else's legs because he's further down the stairs. And it still kind of conveys that sense of motion. It's the kind of thing that this artist is able to do well, but I think other artists could try and mess up on if they're not careful. It was a subtle touch that doesn't interfere with the story, but once you realize what's going on, I think it's kind of cool.
Yeah, so I mean, I think that Marcos Martin and Paulo Rivera, that for this book, they're doing a good job on the art. You know, mm-hmm. It's like I had coming into it a bit of a bias against them just because, you know, I'm not on Spider-Man. I'm a little bit of a purist. I kind of like more of the, you know, a little more Romita-ish kind of art on those. Whereas on Daredevil, there's been so many art styles in that book over the years that I'm a little more flexible. I think it works well on this book.
Well, going back to that two-page spread where they're going down the street, what I liked on that is they've got kind of a couple areas where they've highlighted squares or whatever, and it's what Matt's senses have kind of honed in on.
Right. That was actually kind of cool, a visual that he chose to do. And I thought that was a really well done thing. So I got to reassess my Marcos Martin opinion based on this book. He won me over with it.
Mm-hmm. Well, and he's building up in just that the two-page spread a visual vocabulary of this is how he is seeing with his radar vision certain things, how he is smelling certain aspects, how he is hearing certain things down the street or whatever. And that panel, it's funny because as I was reading it, the sound effect that came to my mind was the one they use on Psych when Sean is kind of honing in on various key elements, because that's almost exactly what's happening here. So I was pleased with the backup story in, again, the way it really conveyed the super senses of Daredevil. And, you know, I just thought it was visually very well done and some good storytelling there. And overall, for me, this is a very solid 4 out of 5 book. I think it sets things up well for a new era of Daredevil. Whether newer readers are going to be comfortable with this direction or not remains to be seen, but if not, it's certainly not because of any lack of quality. I think these guys are doing a good job.
Yeah, I similarly gave it a 4 out of 5, and I am really curious to see how people are going to react to this take on Daredevil. I mean, I really like it. I think it's very well done. Wade, of course, is one of our favorite writers. We both like what he does, mm-hmm. and I think he did a really effective job on this. The art complemented it really well. It's just, you know, how is this take on the characters going to go over, you know, with people who have grown up on a different look at Daredevil. But, you know, boy, especially coming off of the Shadowland stuff.
Yeah.
If that didn't set them up for this being a lot better than that, I don't know what else could. I mean, if this would have come, like, right after, you know, Brubaker and Bendis and those guys, might have had a little bit different reaction. Now it's like, oh, please give me anything that's actually readable on Daredevil. You know, and this certainly was.
I think, to me, the big difference is with Shadowland, he was at such a dark spot that for him to be coming at this point where he is now, now granted we had the Reborn miniseries in between, it's a fairly stark contrast between the two, kind of the ends of the spectrum. And again, I think it's going to be interesting to see if readers want this kind of happy-go-lucky Daredevil or not. And I think Wade's a good person to bring this take to life, but, you know, we'll see.
Yeah. Now we are moving into Image Comics with Marksmen, plural. I think you can take some small amount of credit for this being Marksmen, plural, instead of Marksman, singular. Because when I interviewed David Baxter and those guys way back, I think you mentioned there was a title from such and such a comics called Marksmen, and I sent an email off to the guys and I said, did you guys know this one? They're like, oh, let us check on that. And then the next thing we knew, it was like, it was called Marksmen, and they had changed the title to make it plural.
Well, because there was a Marksman character from Heroic Publishing, or maybe Hero Publishing at that point, which was one of the Champions characters from the role-playing game. And he was essentially, as one might expect, a guy with a gun who was a really good shot, you know? It is funny these days how I think some people do not do, and it's understandable, checking up on the, is this name been used before, or whatever. And it gets harder and harder to do every day because more and more names get used. But it does seem like in a few cases you could just pick up the Overstreet Price Guide and do a little bit of research pretty easy.
I think Marksmen works better anyway.
Yeah.
Plural. Because it makes it, you know, kind of like the unit that he's in as opposed to just the single guy, you know, like this kind of classification of guys. But anyway, this is a post-apocalyptic kind of thing. There's been a massive recession in the United States. Where might David Baxter have gotten that idea from? The government has collapsed, and a civil war has erupted between cities and states to keep resources to themselves. One of the places that has arisen from the ashes is New San Diego. It's got scientists there. It's got the Navy SEALs and the, you know, the Marine Corps bases. You know, it's a very of towns in the U.S. San Diego, I think, actually is one that would still classify as a military town. There's so many bases there. I know when my dad, one of the reasons why we ended up in California is when he mustered out of the Marine Corps in World War II, he mustered out in San Diego, and he spent some time there. And then when he was like deciding to move away from what he was perceived as the frozen wasteland of Chicago, you know, he thought back to really liking Southern California, and we ended up in L.A. But, you know, very military town there. And I like this series. I mean, I like post-apocalyptic stories in general. It didn't hurt that they, like, kind of threw in some kind of cool little San Diego references. You got the Petco Park there. You've got, they're using the convention center as a military command base. And they've got, you know, pictures of the convention center, which we're in future issues going to see more of the inside of the convention center. But, you know, kind of like that aerial shot, you know, it's like, oh, okay, downtown San Diego. Pick out your hotel.
Well, I got to say, I think Ben Arroyo is doing a really smart move by putting these first issues they're doing out at $1.
Oh, yeah, that's a really good point. They've been doing that with all the books that they've come out with so far. And, you know, it's like it or not, I mean, I think it's a great opportunity because for a buck, you know, go to your store and try it out. Maybe you'll like it, maybe you won't, but you're not really out a whole lot on trying the thing for a buck. And if you like it, hey, you know, get the other five issues for $2.99 a piece. And if you don't, hey, you gave it a shot.
Mm-hmm. Well, and this is a full 32 pages of story. So as far as the value for the dollar, you're getting it. And I really, really respect how they're standing behind their product and trying to give it a firm foothold in the market on these first issues and making it that much harder to for readers and retailers to pass up. And I hope that pays off for them. Now, I'm not a huge fan of the post-apocalyptic type stories. I don't hate them or anything, but not something I go out of my way to seek. Overall, for me, this story was not bad, but it wasn't great either. And there was something about the storytelling style that just didn't click with me, and I'm not entirely sure what some of that was. Because these guys told a decent story and did so competently, so it's not like they were amateurish in any way. I mean, it's good art, it's a good story, but it almost read to me like one of those kind of generic low-budget post-apocalyptic sci-fi movie, TV movies or whatever you'd see that the Sci-Fi Channel will have on a couple of times a month or something. And there's nothing wrong with those. Those can be a lot of fun. But I didn't find anything that felt particularly new or massively innovative here. And again, I don't expect that out of every story. But none of the characters were overly intriguing to me. There was nothing that really pulled me into this story thinking, wow, I just love it. Now, I liked it. I thought it was good. But there was something, and I don't know if it was the use of the splash pages or how some pages had virtually no dialogue. There was something about the storytelling pacing here that just wasn't working for me. And I'm not sure what it was because, you know, as I look at these pages, they've got a really good artist here. They're telling a story sequentially that moves forward and stuff. So I haven't been able to identify what it was that kept me out of the story for some reason, because this isn't a bad story or a bad comic. And I don't think it's just that I'm not predisposed to like, you know, post-apocalyptic things or whatever. It's just, I don't know, there was something. And there were a couple of places where it was a little gorier and more profane than I care for, but, you know, that really wasn't an issue for me. There were a couple of parts where I also felt they were doing a lot of exposition, but they've got a whole world to set up here, so you're gonna have that, and I thought they did so reasonably effectively to set up why New San Diego is the way it is, why Lone Star is the way it is, and why the two are just definitely going to be at odds. And they build an interesting post-apocalyptic world here.
I think it's because they made the Texans the bad guys. That, like, just didn't set well with you.
That could be. I don't know. I mean, I'm from San Diego, so...
But now you live in Texas.
Yeah?
So you're conflicted in your deep core of your being.
Now, the other thing that may have done it is the first page here. We start out in the emptiness at the remains of a Shell station on Interstate 8. And then the next caption is, formerly Apache Junction, Arizona, where the guy is looking at said gas station. Apache Junction's, what, about 40 miles from Interstate 8? So I think the geography here is a little bit different than in our world. Again, who the hell cares? It's not a big deal. But it was something that made it feel a little off.
Yeah, you drive by there every year.
Yeah, I just drove almost the entire length of Interstate 8. And then the cityscape we see of San Diego when they first get there. Great visual and a good establishing shot, but it just seemed like somebody had bulldozed around those remains of San Diego in a kind of an odd way or whatever. But it is kind of cool how they're using, like you said, the landmarks of the convention center, which they've got pretty much spot on, Petco Park and stuff like that. This is one that I definitely think there is an audience for. I don't know that I'm really part of that target audience necessarily. I do think, again, particularly for the fact it's a buck, they're giving you 30 pages of story. They've got a lot in this issue. It's a fairly packed issue. I would say it's easily the story content of two issues of a regular comic, at least. And again, I commend them for that. They put a lot of work into this. They did a lot of good stuff. For me personally, it didn't really click, didn't really work, but I do think people should check this out and judge for themselves.
Yeah, I liked it a lot more than you did, but I like post-apocalyptic kind of stories. And I like, you know, if you like Mad Max, or again, if you like those kind of sci-fi movies that are set in this kind of a landscape, you know, after the fall of society, you know, kind of thing, this will be up your alley. I mean, if you're not big on that kind of stuff, then, you know, they're kind of fighting an uphill battle in the first place. But I think that for me, I like the main character. I'm really curious on how they're going to develop him, because, you know, you got a lot with him. You got a little bit of characterization. You didn't get a tremendous amount of characterization with him. You know, I like the, you know, not everybody's got, you know, because again, like that Mad Max thing, you know, fuel is in short supply, so he's riding a horse, and he's got his wolf as a companion. That's kind of cool. You know, it's gonna, gives you that little bit of a Western flavor to it. You know, you got the guy on his horse, and he's got his dog, or in this case, a wolf. You got the pretty girl who also is, you know, really tough as nails and can really hold her own, you know, out there. And you got the, you know, evil bad guys, you know. So, you know, a lot of these cliches getting put together. But, you know, it's, you know, they're mixed together in a configuration that's not exactly the same as ones that I've seen before in the genre. So I was okay with that.
Well, and I think that's worth pointing out, because it's not like I feel like I've read this story before, but I've read a lot of stories that have various little elements that are showing up here. Because again, like you said, those are aspects of the genre. You know, you're going to have that.
One thing I'd be curious about, and it might even be playing into the story in future issues, is you made the point of when they first come upon San Diego, it almost looks like they bulldozed around it. And I'm thinking they might have done just that.
Yeah.
They might have made a kill zone to secure that area, because it looks like there's that one way in, and they've purposely, like, kind of cleared out the suburbs, you know, and low houses that are around the downtown area, and have made a very flat approach zone for the security, almost like building a moat around a castle.
Exactly. So, strategically, it's a very smart move.
Yeah. So it would be curious to see if they, you know, go into something, or at least drop a little hint or something about it, where, you know, that, yes, they actually did that on purpose for the security of the town, you know, because you're going to have this this rampaging horde of Texans come swarming in, and they've got to go across that open field to get at San Diego. I'm curious to, you know, it's like six issues, and we got like 30 pages here, and we're already having this big confrontation. Well, that's obviously not going to get resolved in issue number two. So, you know, for me, it left me at a point where different story could have spent the entire six-issue series building up to these guys swarming in on their horses, and that being the climactic final battle.
That could have been the end of issue five in the sixth. Yeah, yeah.
And this is happening at the end of issue one, you know, so
it begs the question of, if this is the opening act, what's going to be the big fight or whatever at the end?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah,
exactly. So, you know, I think that in the genre, they could have gone a little easier on it, you know, and told a very decompressed story where, you know, what you've got in this issue plus probably the first half of next issue, that would be an entire series of a lot of other things. Mm-hmm. And it's going to be the first issue and a half of six here. So, you know, I'm really curious to see where it's going with this, and I'm looking forward to it. But again, I kind of like this kind of story, so I'm predisposed to, you know, to be liking this kind of thing. So I saved a lot of money on the first issue, you know, and I'm on board for the rest myself. I gave it a 4 out of 5, personally. Like the genre and like the way that David Baxter told the story here in the first issue.
I gave it a strong 3 out of 5. Again, while it didn't click with me, it it was well done, and they did what I think they set out to do. Again, they told a lot of story there. Marketing-wise, I would give it a higher rating because, again, I think they're standing behind their product with the dollar promotional price for the first issue. I really respect that. I think that's a smart move. Definitely think that there is no reason for anybody who thinks this might be something they could possibly like. There's no reason not to go check out that first issue and judge for yourself. It didn't work for me, but again, I'm not really big into these types of stories. The art's good, the story's good, and again, the 32 pages of story for the dollar, how can you go wrong, even if you decide not to continue with the series? So really, go pick up that first issue, and frankly, even if you're not thinking you're going to like it at all, pick up the first issue just to support the fact they're doing these at a buck. Let's have that pay off for these guys so they keep doing it.
Yeah, I got a couple of extras, and I gave them to some of my son's friends who read comics who like the, you know, kind of post-apocalyptic kind of genre. I said, hey, these were cheap. Have one.
Yeah, cool.
So that's what we had this week.
Yeah, and that's the sum total of all the comics I've read since getting back from Con, so I got nothing else to talk about.
We're going to maybe try to get a Con wrap-up episode out.
Yeah, we'll see if we can get that coordinated and stuff. It was a good convention, but a tiring one, as always. If you have not been to the San Diego Comic-Con, check out all the coverage that's been done on it this year. It is just phenomenal how much they do, how much they cover, and it is really, I think, kind of the be-all, end-all of Comic-Con, you know, comic book conventions, I should say.
Yeah. If you're somewhere in Southern California, as a, for instance, I know when you come from out of state, you kind of want to get that 4-day pass and make a whole thing out of it. But, you know, I think getting some 1-day passes, you know, 1 or 2 1-day passes and just going for a day is an option. And even if you're coming from out of state, you know, San Diego's a really, really nice vacation destination. If you've got, you know, a girlfriend, wife, kids, you know, that don't necessarily want to spend 4 days or 5 days at a convention, get a 1-day pass, go to the con for a day, and then spend the other days going to the zoo and the beaches and SeaWorld and bring your kids up to Legoland. And, you know, there's a whole bunch of things to do in the San Diego area that aren't Comic-Con.
Well, and one of the big selling points for some of us who live, say, in the evil Lone Star Empire here in hot Texas where it's 100 and something every day, it was like 30 degrees cooler out in San Diego. It was wonderful weather.
It was really nice this year. Last year it was a little hotter, but this year, what was like about 70 degrees, 75 degrees or something?
It was like
most
a 72, 74 degree thing throughout. It was
beautiful.
Wonderful.
Beautiful weather. And that was like, there was a heat wave going on in other parts of the country. It was really nice this year.
Yeah.
We don't always get the really nice, but, you know, it's right on the water. And, you know, more often than not, I mean, I remember more really nice years than I remember the few, you know, kind of hot and uncomfortable years.
There was one or two where it was really kind of like in the 90s or something, kind of hot and a little miserable. But again, once in a while. If you have not been to San Diego, though, I think there's a lot of merit in what Bob's suggesting of that 1-day pass, because you're not going to see the entire convention in the 1 day, but it's very overwhelming and a lot of sensory overload. So 1 day is probably a good kind of entry point and, you know, survival tactic. Because I personally find the convention very energy draining, just being around that many people. That much noise, that much sensory overload. It's fun, it's great, but I just come out of it exhausted. So, but again, we'll try to do an episode on that soon and go through all the ins and outs of the convention. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah. definitely the pop culture event of the year. You know, comics and video and Hollywood and all that other kind of stuff. But, you know, just the comics content of this convention is more than probably any other single convention, even though you have all the other stuff grafted on it, too.
Yeah, the place is just gargantuan. We're going to be doing the preview spotlight on August 12th.
Yeah, the Diamond, I don't know when they announced it, but I got word this week that they're shipping late again. It did not come out on the last Wednesday of the month.
The preview stuff, yeah.
The previews. So, you know, we'll be slipping a week because of that. So previews will be coming out on, I guess, Wednesday, August
3rd.
Instead of the last Wednesday of July, which would have been the 27th. And, you know, everything will slip back a bit as a result. So,
but as soon as you guys have clips to send in for the preview spotlight, we appreciate getting those as early as possible. Just gives us a little more time to kind of prepare for the episode and stuff. And we just like hearing what you guys are looking forward to give us some ideas of what we might want to get to.
Yep, and even though, as you listen to this, if you're listening to it in the first few days that it goes up, previews is still not on the street. Go out to the forum, look for the previews thread, and we've got links in there to the online solicits for all the major and several of the second tier publishers. And when I say major, I'm talking like not just, you know, all the front half of previews.
The premier publishers.
The premier publishers, and as well as, you know, several others. And as those links become available, I usually add to that thread. So you can see the solicits out online. You don't have to physically buy a preview. You know, we call it the preview spotlight, but you don't have to physically have a previews catalog to participate or even care about it. Just look at the stuff online.
Yeah. The bottom line is, what are you interested in that's in that batch of solicitations? Because that's kind of what we're using as the boundary points. We don't want to be talking about something that's coming out a year and a half from now. And believe me, at San Diego, they announced a ton of such things. Some of which I'm very much looking forward to, but I'm going to kind of ignore until I see the solicitation, knowing that it's going to come out in a reasonable time frame.
Yeah.
So. Also, I am a little behind thanks to San Diego on the number crunching. We'll get the Mayo Report stuff up as soon as we can, but that may be another week or two. I'm still waiting on a little information. Everything's kind of a little chaotic since that got released during Comic-Con, which is busy time of year for the entire industry. So, anything else, Bob, or does that pretty much do it?
Does it for me.
Cool.
Join us next week when we discuss Teen Titans number 98 from DC, The Amazing Spider-Man number 666 from Marvel, and Stan Lee's The Traveler number 9 from Boom Studios.
The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. Please email us at theguys@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.